carbons do damage to the rest of your body, the vehicle of nicotine is the addictive part. Regardless of how nicotine reaches the bloodstream, it's distributed through the brain and body, where it activates cholinergic receptors. Nicotine changes these receptors so that a regular user needs to continue to get nicotine to have a normal functioning brain, and stopping can trigger withdrawal symptoms. Plus, nicotine stimulates the release of the reward-seeking chemical dopamine, which supports the pleasure that many smokers feel and makes it so dang hard to stop. That underscores the point that addictive behaviors can change our brain chemistry in ways that make the addiction nearly impossible to break, especially with willpower alone. All addictions have physical, emotional, and social influences, so you often require a pro who can get you off the wrong track and on the right one, as well as a buddy who can help you stay there.
U-tips. These are some of the steps you can take to keep your mind under control. Talk it out. When it comes to reducing the effects of depression, the biggest cure may not be in a pill bottle, but in making sure you don't stay bottled up yourself. In treating minor depression, talk therapy over 6 weeks is 60 to 70% successful, and it's 90% successful when used in conjunction with drugs. How does it work? Probably through the release of those feel-good chemicals, including oxytocin, and learning new coping strategies. One of the more effective treatments for depression is cognitive behavioral therapy. Limited to 10 to 20 sessions, this therapy helps people learn how their thoughts contribute to their symptoms and suggests behavioral changes they can make to change their environment, their response to their environment, and ultimately their thoughts. It doesn't tell you how to feel, but rather it teaches you how to stay calm and cool when you're upset about a problem so that you can figure out what to do and how to feel better. It's why therapists ask a lot of questions rather than make a lot of statements. But even just talking about your problem with your spouse, friends, or a taxi driver can help. Since women tend to speak much more than men, they may get a much larger brain chemical boost from hashing things out. Go bananas! Eating a banana every day facilitates both crosstalk among your brain cells and the effect of certain neurotransmitters such as serotonin and its precursors. These two effects may mean that eating a banana a day helps keep the therapist away by preventing recurring minor depression. Plus, besides coffee, bananas are our largest dietary source of antioxidants. You heard that right. Sweat it out. Exercise has been shown to be more effective than many antidepressants in reducing major depression. Part of that may be attributed to the endorphin effect of exercise. We feel that the sense of purpose and accomplishment that comes with regular exercise also helps. Sometimes action has to come before motivation, and depressed folks need to act to prime their motivational engine. Yoga is specifically associated with decreased depressive symptoms and increased mood, perhaps partly because of the deep breathing that's done during the practice. Rub alcohol from the scene. While some people medicate their emotions with something from the freezer, others do it with something from the bottle. Make sure you or someone you love doesn't have an alcohol problem that's masking a depression problem or is an addiction in and of itself. You can do so by asking these questions. Answering yes to any of them is a red flag. Have you tried to cut down on drinking but failed? Have you ever been annoyed by someone criticizing your drinking? Have you ever felt guilty about drinking? Have you ever taken a morning eye-opener, tailgating parties excluded? Have you ever had a problem with drinking? Don't say don't. You'd think that repeatedly telling someone not to drink, not to smoke, or not to download pictures of naked women to their work computer would be enough. But your brain can do very funny things. Your brain, specifically the part of the brain that influences cravings, your insula, hears "don't smoke" and reacts as if it hears "smoke." That stimulates the craving for smoking. A much better approach when you want to help someone get rid of an addiction. Flip the message. Instead of saying "don't smoke," say "breathe free." Instead of saying "don't eat donuts," say "have a handful of nuts." Instead of saying "don't look at naked pictures," say "want to get naked?" Give yourself time. Docs are taught that the normal time period for emotional recovery from the loss of a loved one is 6 months to a year after the death. So it may seem natural to experience depressive symptoms during that time. But we also want to make it clear that you should never feel pressure to shake the pain after a certain time period. Illusions are also part of normal grief. An illusion is a misperception of an actual external stimulus. Delusions or hallucinations are never normal. The key is getting to the point where you can weather the discomfort enough to carry on with other aspects of your life. Test yourself. You say he's got a problem. He says there's nothing wrong with brushing every tooth individually 24 times a day. How do you know the difference between nuance and annoyance? These criteria will help you judge whether someone has a personality disorder. They likely do if their behavior is inflexible no matter what the situation the person is in, leads to problems in their work or social life, is not part of some other mental disorder, is not a direct effect of a medical condition, drug, or medication. Write at bedtime. Approach every day with an attitude of thankfulness. Impossible expectations lead to sadness. Try to write a gratitude journal every day. Writing 3 thank you notes a day really does make it less likely that you will suffer depression. While you're at it, put some music on in the background. Research suggests that music can improve moderately depressed moods. One study also showed improved heart rate and blood pressure. The worry war. Solve your most troubling job and money issues. You test burnout. Answer the following questions with a yes or no, considering how you feel today only. Do you feel as worn down as a 100,000-mile tire? When you think about your boss, your kids, your food-begging parrot, or anyone else in your life making demands, do you feel primarily anger? Do you feel overwhelmed or besieged by work? Do you explode easily, even at trivial issues? Do you suffer from headaches, gastrointestinal distress, or insomnia? Are you considered the resident Evel Knievel, taking unnecessary risks? Are you stressed out by money issues more than once a month? Answer. Ideally, we want you to answer no to all of these questions. If you nodded in the affirmative to any, it's a sign you may be suffering from burnout and stress. The more yes answers you have, the faster you're on your way to a total meltdown.
We all know at least one person who frets about everything. The weather, the plug in the coffee machine, who's going to make the American Idol final. We have a name for these chronic fretters, worrywarts. Although none of us actively inspires to be a worrier, worrying does serve an important purpose. From an evolutionary standpoint, worry signals a lack of confidence, knowledge, or control. Where are we going to sleep tonight? What's for dinner? What's that rustling in the bushes? Today's big questions are a little bit different. We worry about paying bills. We worry about our career path. We worry about the health of ourselves and our families. Fundamentally, this also serves some purpose. Worry helps us take action to ease our stress and anxiety. When you think about it, beauty is often about managing all the different kinds of stresses in your life. Since we've covered so many of the major stressors through the book, we want to tackle the two other big stressors in people's lives, money and work. The truth is that of the 10 identified major stressors, 6 of them involve money or work. So while there's a lot to cover relating to stress, we want to break through to you first on these topics. As we'll explore throughout this section, stress can work for you in many ways. Stress helps you meet deadlines and make tough decisions under pressure. What we don't want, however, is for work and finance-related stress to adversely affect your health or for it to control you, suffocate you, and make you feel about as vibrant as muddy socks. Your work, frazzled or dazzled? There's no question that our society has a collective career crisis. Work is killing us. Just consider these facts. This you think it's not a big deal for you. A third of all new illnesses are due to work-related stresses. In each case of work-related major stress, depression or anxiety leads to an average of 30 working days lost a year. That's 6 weeks of work. Work-related stress is second only to back pain in terms of work-related health problems. And stress causes some of that back pain. Yikes. You don't have to be an MD to know that stress can cause headaches, sleep problems, appetite problems, and other psychological problems such as depression and anxiety. And that's not even considering the fact that work stress has been linked to gastrointestinal problems, hormonal problems, immune problems, and increased risk of metabolic syndrome, that's omental obesity, with high blood pressure, high lousy and low healthy cholesterol levels, high triglyceride levels, and high blood sugar, as well as a 6-fold higher risk of having a heart attack. Double yikes. Here's how it works in your body. You have a stress circuit that loops between your central nervous system and your stress hormones, called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. When you're faced with a major stressor, the hypothalamus releases a hormone called CRH, which then causes your pituitary gland to release another hormone called ACTH into your bloodstream. That's the hormone that signals your adrenal glands to release the stress hormone cortisol, which in turn gets your adrenaline cranked up. Adrenaline, by the way, is the fight or flight hormone. All of this is fine and good for a while. The increased heart rate and blood pressure gets you away from any predator. But if the stress doesn't stop, this flood of chemicals turns against you, compromising your immune system, exhausting your adrenal glands, throwing your cholesterol levels way out of whack, and causing you to crave sugar and syrups that age you. And your prefrontal cortex, which, if you listened to it, would have prevented you from getting into the problem in the first place, is bypassed again. And guess what? Financial stresses and work stresses aren't one-time muggers. They're constantly battling you, meaning that chronic stress has a real potential for pummeling your insides. What's really fascinating from a scientific perspective is the bridge between good stress and bad stress. The truth is that some amount of stress can be good for you and your job performance, which ultimately relieves stress, right? So where's the fine line between acute stress that works in your favor and chronic stress that makes you feel like retreating to the couch for the next 3 weeks? Good question, tough answer. It varies for everyone, but certainly some patterns emerge. Chronic stress typically develops because your job includes one or more of these factors. It's boring, with repetitive tasks, there's a low level of control in your job, annoying coworkers, low level of job security, working the night shift or rotating shifts, and being exposed to loud noises. Having a job with one of those characteristics makes you more susceptible to the negative effects of stress and not feeling beautiful. Being exposed to all makes you a walking volcano. The tactics we'll outline at the end of this section can help you manage these nagging things, but perhaps more important, they'll help you look at the bigger picture, whether you're even at the right place at the right time in your career.
Your finances. Money matters. Without money, we have no food, no shelter, no iPods. We use it for necessities. We crave it for luxuries. And no matter how much we make, spend, save, or donate, we can't deny that money is as important to our overall well-being as almost anything else. Why? In today's material world, net worth is often confused with self-worth, and this faulty leap of logic has created a heap of problems. For many, more money means having more power, more control, more confidence, and thus more to worry about. And many of us get caught up in a keeping up with a Joneses mentality, where we need to spend money whenever others do. To further worsen the worry potential, men and women have decidedly different views about money. These gender differences are probably rooted in our evolutionary past, when men did the hunting and women the gathering. Today's modern man, like his Stone Age cousin, doesn't think twice about going out and bagging a new car, then proudly coming home with his trophy yelling, "Honey, come down here and look at the new SUV I got you." To which his wife might respond, "Why didn't you ask me what I wanted? I thought we were a team." Which might trigger him to ask, "What, are you my mother?" It's no wonder, then, that financial problems are among the most common reasons for divorce. Though nearly 60% of couples say they rarely disagree about money and are doing just fine with their finances, some research shows that 1/4 of all married couples divorce because of financial issues. Homo economicus, financial decision-making. We like to think of ourselves as rational decision makers, dispassionate, information processors, coolly, calmly, and logically evaluating the costs and benefits of each alternative we encounter. But we're much more primitive than most of us realize. We may look like a Wall Street type on the outside, but there's still a good deal of Fred Flintstone on the inside. Remember the emotions we talked about in reference to anxiety, how we're hardwired through the amygdala to react to emotions, not intellect. That's the very reason why we can have financial troubles. Just consider this example. Recently, a team of Ivy League economists looked at how consumers reacted to various pitches by banks to take out a loan. A purely rational view would have predicted that interest rates would be the only factor that had an impact. The lower the rate, the more people would borrow money from that bank. But the scientists varied more than just the interest rate. They also tested how persuasive other approaches might be. For instance, some letters offered a chance to win a cell phone in a lottery if the customer came in to inquire about a loan. The researchers found that many non-financial factors had an effect equal to 1 to 5 percentage points of interest. An offer of a free cell phone increased demand among men as much as dropping the interest rate 5 points. For a $50,000 loan, this meant that some men were in essence willing to pay $16,000 more in interest to receive a $100 cell phone. So much for logical decision making. This study highlights what is perhaps the single greatest barrier to mastering our money problems, our near universal tendency to grab small short-term gains to our long-term disadvantage. So why do many of us make these apparently irrational decisions? From an evolutionary standpoint, our near obsession with the short term at the expense of the long makes perfect sense. At least it did 100,000 years ago. Our Stone Age ancestors lived at a time when there is a reasonable chance of dying during the course of any given day. Back then, hearing the phrase, "Honey, I'm home," really meant something. Your decisions didn't make it to your frontal cortex, where risk and gains are balanced. It seems clear, and with good reason, that humans in that older era began to equate delayed benefits with significant degree of risk, since there was such a reasonable chance that future benefits would never be realized. So for the average Stone Ager, the decision to go with the smaller, sure, instant reward was hardly irrational. To do anything else now would have been crazy. Our problem is that what was Mensa brilliant back in the old days doesn't work quite as well today. We see evidence of our short-sighted tendencies all the time in today's society. People won't spend more money on a more expensive air conditioner, even if it means they'll pay smaller energy bills for years down the line. Today, the immediate response of your reptilian brain tends to win out over tomorrow, the prefrontal cortex. Even though not having enough for tomorrow is the source of stress that sits like a 3-ton boulder on your shoulders. It's the same concept that derails most diets. The pleasures of our nutritional sins, hot dogs, cheesecake, win out over the benefits of the way nutritional foods will take care of us tomorrow. More energy and less pain tomorrow if you eat blueberries and walnuts today. Most likely, your prefrontal cortex often doesn't get consulted in the mall or the food court. You rely on your reptilian brain. That evolutionary problem wouldn't be a problem if credit cards and leverage didn't exist now. But they do, and you're not consulting your prefrontal cortex often causes you to overspend and thus be burdened with financial stress. Unfortunately, short-sightedness isn't the only force that pushes our financial instincts in irrational directions that ultimately make us feel less beautiful. Outsmart your instincts. All our short-sighted bad habits are, at least theoretically, reversible. The newer areas of our brains, the frontal lobes, can moderate or even shut down our instinctual behaviors. In fact, as you get older, you seem to get smarter by relying more on your prefrontal or frontal cortex before you make decisions. It may take a little longer, but you make more rational and less instinctual and less risky decisions. Nearly alone among animals, we can delay our gratification and choose not to give into a strong, short-term urge. The big picture strategy is to look at these two factors in yourself. Your locus of control. Basically, locus of control refers to whether you're the kind of person who believes either that the oncoming bus was destined to pluck you from the sidewalk or that you had the power to make a decision about whether you were going to put a foot out before the sign blinked walk. Do you believe that your behavior controls fate or fate controls you? Interesting question, eh? People who have a strong internal locus of control see themselves as being in control of their lives. They're highly motivated. They have the power to steer their career and familial paths, and they make decisions that can change the course of their lives. They can influence, even employ, many productive people. They are those who follow their dreams and change the world, handle stress, and are really happy with their careers. Those with an external locus, you got it. They blame the weather, they blame their bosses, they blame whatever supernatural power they believe in for dealing them a bad hand in life. Bad thoughts make your brain focus on negative rather than your passion in life. So no matter what locus of control you now have, get ready to shift to positive thoughts only. Of course, most of us exhibit both kinds of loci. It's just that one may be more dominant. To decrease work stress and feel more beautiful, start thinking with the scales tipped more towards an internal locus, that you have the power to love your job, to create a better world, and to handle tough tasks. that you have the ability to make more money, and you have the authority to determine that a lousy career isn't just some hand you've been dealt with through a series of unfortunate incidents. Your emotional intelligence. Since stress certainly has a heavy emotional component, it stands to reason that your ability to think with your emotions can help you manage them. Huh? Think with your emotions. Let us explain. In fact, you don't think with emotions. You're hardwired to react with emotions. Since that's what got you here, that's how your ancestors survived, that's generally a good thing. In patients who have strokes that knock out their emotional centers, they can no longer make rational decisions. Ironically, humans need that emotional center to make rational decisions. Stress-related emotions don't have to be automatically classified as yelling at interns, or punching the wall, or rushing off to the restroom to cry with the velocity of the faucet. Emotional intelligence can actually be thought of as a form of problem-solving in times of stress. How so? Well, emotional intelligence can really be broken down into four abilities or skills that can help you cope with stress. IDing emotions. Tangibly identify with what you're feeling, making sure to look deeper than surface-level reactions. Let's say you're jealous over someone else's success. Ask yourself if you're really truly jealous, or maybe upset that you haven't achieved what you wanted to. Facilitating emotions. When you're feeling multiple emotions, think about different points of view to help you solve problems. In our jealousy example, identify your obstacles and figure out ways around them, rather than letting jealousy get you off track. Understanding emotions. Understand that emotions aren't as black and white as salt and pepper, and that we all experience complex chains of emotions, and we can learn to understand and even change the emotions of others, be they bosses, coworkers, or customers. Managing emotions. This skill doesn't mean being able to hide your crying until you get to the restroom. Rather, it's what lets you determine whether an emotion is appropriate so you can solve problems that are emotionally based. Next time you're feeling jealous, for example, you'll be able to harness that emotion more quickly and better manage your feelings and subsequent behaviors. Once you establish this foundation of control over your stressors, you're better able to tackle the problems more specifically. UTIPs. When it comes to money, we're not going to tell you what your stock portfolio should look like, but we are going to try and steer you to make choices that will help you feel better and live longer by learning how to work past the biology of decision-making that gets you into trouble. Score a perfect 10. Of all the financial decisions you will make over your life, this one is a no-brainer. Every time you get paid, take 10% of that check and put it into an emergency account. It doesn't count for retirement, it's not used for bills, and it's not something you tap into when you decide that you really, really need an automatic lollipop maker. It's something that will give you peace of mind. Having an emergency backup account to use if the car dies, or if your spouse needs an extra hand to help with an illness, or you need to go to a different job, or the roof leaks, while still being able to pay bills, save for retirement, and make investments, is the thing that will relieve your day-to-day financial stress as much as anything short of winning the Super Six. Huddle up. Too often it seems that we treat money issues as some taboo topic. We don't talk about our financial philosophies until hubby comes home with a brand new motorboat, and then all hell breaks loose. Since financial styles affect a marriage as much as parenting styles and sexual styles do, it's only smart to talk about the coin well before your wedding vows. Considering the staggering statistic of how many couples break up over the almighty dollar, you need a conversation about long-term goals, about short-term needs, about budgets, about emergency plans, and about an overall financial strategy that will keep your account and marriage intact. Write it down. Carry a small notebook or diary with you in your purse or bag and record your daily purchases for 1 month. At the end of the month, sit down and look at your purchases and consider how to cut back or improve by 10%. You'll likely be amazed what you can live without. Shift to energy management. You know what we hear all the time from people who feel more overworked than a Buffalo snowplow driver? I have no time. No time to think, no time to work, no time to tell people I have no time. So what we all think we have in today's day and age is a time management problem. We're overburdened and undermanned. You know what we think? It actually has little to do with time at all. Our problem is more of an energy management problem. If we feel energized, excited, jazzed, and ready to rock at work, time management is no longer an issue. And you get to a somewhat cosmic point, like the zone for athletes, where you're managing time efficiently and smartly. You can't wait to get to work, and you enjoy going home as well. So really, your goal maybe shouldn't be to delegate more or take on less. It should be to manage your health so you feel as energized as a caffeinated puppy without having to rely on artificial and temporary means to do so. Find a buddy. The best way to enjoy your job more? Have a buddy or best friend at work. A good buddy will help keep your blood pressure lower and the pounds off. But it has to be one with whom you share similar goals. If you choose an overweight buddy, you'll be more likely to adopt those habits that will also make you overweight. Having a friend there will help you to be more productive at work too, which will also lower stress. The Gallup organization has found we're more productive at work and don't miss as much time when we have a buddy or best friend at work. Why? Maybe we feel an obligation, that accountability to the buddy, and we enjoy our work more. Stay put. Owning your home, paying off your mortgage, has more health benefits than continually switching homes. Realize that the average American sells his or her home every 7 years. So if you're in a starter home, you should consider staying for a while longer than you anticipated. The benefit is twofold. Longer-term home ownership lets you accumulate financial value as well as giving you more availability to spend on healthy choices. A double bonus of stress busters. Pick your passion first, paycheck second. When it comes to careers, a lot of people have it backward. They pick a career because they think they'll make a lot of money in it. Maybe they will and maybe they won't. But if you pick something you don't like and end up not making money, then your brain can feel more fizzled than shaken up soda. So what we tell young people all the time is for them to find a career that they're passionate about. Do that, and you'll naturally excel because you'll love what you're doing, and in many cases, the money will follow. You be the puppeteer. Too often we let the boss steer us, strong-arm us, scare us, and bleep us over to this side of Saturday. And while we surely have to answer to our superiors, there are also ways that you can handle a boss who's difficult to work with. First tactic, stop thinking about your boss in the principal model. That is, you're the student and she's the principal. And the only way you'll end up in the office is if you do something very, very bad. Second tactic, strip the hierarchy of some of the perceived power at the top. You can never have a bad dialogue with a boss if you start with the exact same premise and goals, that you're both out to help the customers and clients. To help your boss is to help the company. With some dialogue that evens the playing field, we both want what's best for the customer, so let's figure out the best path. There's less backstabbing and more back patting. Control your flow. While it would be a mistake for us to assume there's only one way to work, we also do think there are some traits and behaviors that can make time and energy management a whole lot easier. Some things you should consciously try to integrate into your workday if you don't already. Map your day. So you don't have to stick to an exact schedule, you can get some stress relief if you can organize your tasks and not leave your day to total chance. Don't work off your inbox. Work off your plan for the day. Manage the inbox only after you've done what you desire to do. Break often. Take a walk, have a bottle of water, clear your head. It's all part of energy management. The few minutes you spend away from the desk will make you more efficient when you get back. Enlist troops. We know that people are pretty stubborn when it comes to trying to accomplish goals on their own. They think it's a sign of failure if they show weakness or an inability to do a job. But you'll reduce stress and save time by asking for help when you need it. Repurpose your lists. Whether you work for a company or your family, we bet that you live and die by the list. Doesn't matter whether you use post-its, a notebook, a whiteboard, a PDA, or scraps of tissue. We want you to keep not only a to-do list, but also an I-hate list. That is, when something bothers you in your job, write it down. Revisit the list in a week. If it's still bothering you, maybe it's time to aggressively pursue a solution or another job. Our guess, most of the time those annoyances will be as fleeting as a one-hit wonder. And that should help you realize that it's the big picture, not the little one, that counts. For times when that list grows too fast, well, it's always smart to keep your resume handy. After all, you're going to follow an internal locus of control, correct? Ask for it. Face it, your boss doesn't want to give you a raise. It's more money away from his bottom line. But does that mean you ought to roll up into a ball of dough when talking about making more dough? No way. The truth is that women earn about 11% less than men with equivalent education and experience. In one interesting study, researchers told participants they'd be paid anywhere from $3 to $10 to play Boggle. At the end, they were paid $3. And guess what happened? 8 times more men than women asked for more money. Similarly, 4 times as many men as women report they negotiate for more money during a job offer. The message, ask, ask, ask. Never hang up. Every 5-year increase in age at retirement is associated with a 10% decrease in mortality, especially from heart, perhaps because when you retire, you lose a reason for the heart to keep beating. Even if you quit your lifelong day job, pick up another responsibility, so you have to get up in the morning and fulfill a purpose. But plan for retirement anyway. Even though that we advocate that you never really retire from working, in the sense that you instead would watch bad TV all day long, you still need to plan for the time when you step away from your main source of income. Start your 401k plan with as much money as you can afford and can contribute without pain. We advise putting 10% of your salary into a retirement account. By the end of 2 years, you will love your foresight. Have the option to contribute that much or more every year, as well as to increase the percentage contributed with every pay increase. You can survive on what you are making, so each increase that goes to financial security decreases money stress and the large number of illnesses that it causes.
Part 3, Being Beautiful. For some, happiness is a bottle of wine shared with your romantic interest. For others, happiness is a silent walk on the beach in a light rain. Whatever your particular definition of happiness may be, We believe that the idea of being beautiful really comes down to two big umbrella concepts. First, love the people in your life and practice trusting and forgiving them. Second, and equally important, love yourself and all of your imperfections, many of which you're working on to correct, right? Now, be happy with yourself may seem as simple an instruction as fold your underwear, but most of us wrestle with this simple ideal. Why? Because often we find ourselves at odds as we try to balance between two opposing forces. In one corner, we all have a strong, hardwired drive for uniqueness and individuality. And in the other corner, we have a biological need and craving for social conformity and belonging. Sometimes that can be quite a challenge. Be different, but be the same. Stand out from the crowd, but fit in. Why does this even matter? Because being beautiful and finding happiness with ourselves and through our interactions with other people has tremendous health implications. Good relationships with other people can help stave off depression and add years to your life, especially if you're trying to weather the storms of stress. Having internal struggles about your own self-value and purpose in life can increase your chance of developing both physical and mental ailments and influence your overall feeling of happiness, not to mention longevity. One of the reasons why finding this balance is so darn hard is the fact that there can be a canyon-like gap between reality and perception. That is, how you really exist and how others perceive you. Solving this conundrum and opening your world up to look beyond cursory perceptions is what really gives you the inner strength and beauty to find happiness. Ask yourself, do you have relationships that are strong and healthy and contribute to your happiness? Have you found ways to give to others and show gratitude for the gifts you've been given? And are you able to go beyond the superficiality that surrounds you in your day-to-day life to explore and connect with the deeper and more meaningful purposes in life? Those questions really lie at the center of making beauty a full-circle concept. The more beautiful you look and feel, the happier you are. And the happier you are, the more beautiful you look and feel. And the more you can share with others your purpose in life. And that's a beautiful thing. That loving feeling. Improve your relationships with the people close to you. Here's the you test. Quite a pair. How would you describe your current romantic relationship? A, great, nirvana, I found the love of my life. Or is it B, strong and steady, but could use a few more sparks? Or is it C, rocky and bumpy, I'd rather be at work than at home? And D, my only relationship is with the washing machine. Well, clearly the ideal relationship is one that is categorized more like A than any other answer. This section hopes to help you get there if you're not, and to make sure you stay there if you are. One of the amazing things about people is that we all have different goals in our lives. Some of us want to be rock stars, and some of us want to study stars. Some of us want to cook fish, and some of us want to catch them. While our interests, goals, and careers are as different as our facial features, the biggest drive of all is applicable to nearly everyone. Finding that special somebody to call honey, to snuggle with in bed, and to argue with about the best idol contestant. That feeling of love, of bliss, of emotional connection, of physical fireworks lies at the heart of how happy we are. We need other people, love other people, crave other people. Without that singular bond on a romantic level and multiple ones at the family and friend level, it's very hard for most of us to be happy. That said, we should also be clear that our feelings of happiness in relationships extend beyond just the romantic sort. Strong social networks with friends, family, and our pets are strong contributors to our happiness. And the converse is also true. Bad relationships can be a trigger for stress and bad health. While the health benefits of a safe, monogamous sexual relationship are extremely important, research also indicates that strong social ties, such as having a best buddy, are pretty good substitutes for most of the health benefits of a spousal relationship, and they are much better than having an unsatisfied or unhappy spousal arrangement. Here, we're going to explore the biology of our romantic relationships, how we find the right person, and how we continue to love that person. What's especially interesting about this particular topic is that it encapsulates all three components of beauty. You need to look beautiful, at least if you hope to continue the species, because it's used to attract a mate. You need to feel beautiful, the signal that you're healthy and worthy of parenting a potential mate's offspring. And when someone indicates that he or she is attracted to you and interested in what it takes to perpetuate the species, it naturally gives you the joy and confidence you need to be beautiful on every level, love, not to mention the intimate, exciting, body-melting sexual relationship that goes with it, is the biggest beauty boost of them all. The biology of attraction. Before we get into the biology of love and maintaining a happy, healthy, and sexual relationship, we should take a step back and explore what it is that attracts you to your mate in the first place. Your nose. While your initial attraction to someone may be physical, one of the true messengers of love is chemical. We're attracted to people who have good smells, like flowers, and repulsed by those who have bad smells, like dumpsters. Though we tend to spend a lot of time and money disguising our smells with perfume, deodorant, shampoo, and detergents, our brain helps us cut through all that gunk to detect the unique smells of different people. Now, we're not talking about the major kinds of odors that should send you straight to the bath. We're talking about micro smells, called pheromones, that are like dog whistles of the body. They're so subtle that you can't detect them consciously, but they're powerful enough to influence decisions about attraction. Pheromones, sometimes odorless steroids that can be detected at a picogram concentration, that's 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram, flow through the air and stimulate nerves in your nose. The nerve signals are carried to your brain and trigger complicated chemical reactions that ultimately end with a question such as, can I buy you a drink? This is how the theory goes. The pheromone system starts with nerve cells in a pair of tiny cigar-shaped sacs called the vomeronasal organ, or VNO, where the signals are first picked up. Located just behind the nostrils in the nose's dividing wall, the VNO is a pretty primitive structure. The nerve fiber attached to these organs, specifically called cranial nerve zero, because all the other numbers were already taken before it was discovered, responds specifically to scents from potential mates. Nerve zero begins in the nose and ends in the brain area that deals with sex. Because this nerve is important in the sex drive of other animals, people theorize that it plays a big role in our sex drive too. Why? Pheromones and testosterone both seem to be direct drivers of sexual desire and activity in long-term relationships. Even after we find a mate, we can respond to all kinds of pheromones from different people. Some attract us, some repel us. Some research even indicates that specific pheromones applied to the skin increase the amount of sex we have. The biology of love. We've all heard the cliches to describe being in love. Butterflies in the stomach, goo goo gaga eyes, hearts going pitter-patter, loins raging like 300 hungry wolves, and for good reason. Our bodies change when we're in love, and those biological changes are more than just the intangible tugs and tingles we may feel inside. They are real changes that our bodies go through when we're feeling connected with someone, when we're feeling happy. So, for the sake of science, we'd like to disband the poetic cliches to describe love and come up with a new one. Next time you're in love, try a new line. Tell that special someone that your caudate nucleus is on fire. It's true. MRIs show that two parts of your brain, the caudate nucleus and the ventral tegmental area, light up like a movie marquee when you're in the romantic phase of love. Why? Because the love potion ingredient called dopamine is also the addictive substance that sugar, sleep, thirst, and tobacco release. When you're in love and nurture that relationship, your brain pumps out this feel-good chemical. Dopamine drives reward-seeking behavior, or craving, and increases your brain cell's release of the euphoria hormone serotonin. So the better you feel, the more you want. And because that dopamine pathway increases with risk-taking, we often seek what's new and exciting. Unfortunately, you develop a tolerance to dopamine over time. Your brain cells release the same amount, but your receptors turn inward, so they don't get the dopamine message, which is why relationships can lose some of their luster after a few years. One way to continue this chemical high is to try new and sometimes even exotic behaviors to increase dopamine levels and stimulate more receptors. That's why new sex positions and sex in different rooms seem exciting, especially for men. But don't worry, because another hormone, oxytocin, the powerful chemical that makes you feel intimacy and community, comes to the rescue. when apparently unromantic researchers blocked oxytocin in prairie voles. These are animals that mate for life. Those little buggers got right out of their holes, gathered up their music collections, and moved on out. No oxytocin, no intimacy, no lifelong love. Oxytocin, by the way, is also increased by talking, perhaps explaining why communication is so important in relationships. This increase in oxytocin, and really the entire symphony of brain chemicals that influences love, is one reason why 99% of humans live in pair bonds. That's not only marriage, but any intimate relationship with one strong partner, be it a spouse, a significant other, a parent, a sibling, a close friend, or even a cat or dog. Women desire this community feeling more than men. From a survival of the species point of view, it's important that we live in communities, hence the evolution of these biochemical effects. Nevertheless, after around 4 years in a relationship, the chemical tie that drives humans to stick together starts to recede. The timing isn't a coincidence, since by that time, offspring, if there are any, will no longer be entirely dependent on the mother, leaving her better able to provide for herself and her children. Without chemical handcuffs, fathers are much more prone to leave, which is why relationships need to move from being purely romantic to a deeper level of beauty and create a fertile field for lifelong pair bonding. The biology of sex. Humans are the most sexual species around. How do we know? The answer is not from National Geographic specials. One example, women are sexually active for almost their entire lives and throughout all times of their menstrual cycle, meaning that they can choose to have sex even during times when they are physiologically unable to produce offspring. That means that sex must have a higher purpose and function than simple reproduction. Another example, sex drive does not need to decrease with age, meaning that we strongly desire the physical connection even after we're unable to bear children. What's that higher purpose? For one, sex can serve as that nirvana moment between couples, a time when you feel complete happiness and intimacy, a time when you express your love to your mate. In other words, sex is designed to make you feel good, real, real good. How good? For starters, consider that men who have sex 3 times a week can decrease their risk of heart attack and stroke by 50%. Women who enjoy sex tend to live longer than those who don't. Great sex makes your body feel and be the equivalent of 2 to 8 years younger. Same for men who have 150 to 350 orgasms a year, compared to the average of once a week. Having orgasms seems to help decrease general pain. Increasing sex from once a month to once a week, according to researchers, is the happiness equivalent of an additional $50,000 in income for the typical American. While you may think that the biggest sex organ of all is one that's covered up by the latest style from Jockey or Victoria's Secret, your brain is actually your biggest sex organ. Some researchers have said that sexual thoughts, for example, go through a man's brain once every 52 seconds and through a woman's only once a day. And even conservative researchers say that men have many more sexual thoughts than women do. Perhaps that's because men have 2.5 times the amount of brain space devoted to sexual drive than women do. Or because women have more important things to think about. Sex, of course, is more than just thinking about it. It's also about craving it. That craving originates in a part of the brain called the insula. The insula, remembered from earlier, is a primitive area of the brain that is especially active in women who have more frequent orgasms. Let's now look at the way men and women biologically work when it comes to sex. Women. During sex, your pupils dilate, your nostrils flare, the heart rate increases, oxytocin level increases, sweat glands open for cooling, the breasts enlarge by 25%, and nipples increase in height by 1/2 inch. Infrared cameras also show increased blood flow to the lips, nose, and labia. All of these things happen as the sexual stimuli build to an almighty orgasm. A good question to ask right now, why do women have orgasms? Evolutionarily, it was one of the ways that women could tell whether a man would be a good lifelong partner, because it could help women distinguish between a caring, patient male and a selfish or impatient one. Nevertheless, female orgasms can be so subtle that some women don't even know when they've had one. Here's what happens. During intercourse, your vaginal walls make fluids that let your partner's penis slide with just the right amount of friction. together with the sights, sounds, and smells of sex, the stimulation to the clitoris, labia, and breasts all build up a crescendo of intense physical sensation. This is about the time when your brain tells your vagina and nearby muscles to contract. Why? To bring his penis in deeper and increase the chance of his sperm hitting its target, the egg. In the process, some women even ejaculate. During orgasm, the uterus dips in like an anteater and sucks up the semen into the uterus to further increase the chance of fertilization. The female orgasm also causes hormones to increase contractions of the vagina and uterus and helps move semen into the uterus. Women who orgasm between 1 minute before and 45 minutes after their partner's ejaculation have a higher tendency to retain sperm compared to those who don't have an orgasm. The female orgasm, of course, isn't an easy thing to describe. The brain serves as the main conductor in the symphony, but it might involve many different instruments, sometimes including the area known as the G-spot, which is parallel to a gathering of nerves on the male prostate. Women usually do not have a single spot, like some magic sex me here button, but rather a region of nerves like those spread over the surface of the male prostate. That's because as a woman's reproductive organs develop in utero, her rudimentary prostate moves away, so these nerves end up on the vaginal wall. So, if you insert your finger upward into the vagina and make the come here movement, you will touch the G-spot region that exists in most women. This region is often not that sensitive either, but you never know until you try. The fact that women can be stimulated to orgasm through not only the genitals, but also the mouth, nipples, and other parts of the body points to the complexity of the system and reinforces the fact that the true biology of sex really evolves within the brain. Men. It doesn't take a sexologist to know the purpose of the male orgasm. Find the egg, fertilize the egg, begin shopping for Barbies. But what's interesting is that this mad dash to the egg isn't some New York City marathon where all the starter sperm strap on their Nikes with the goal of making it to the finish line. Some of the sperm do that, but others are more like defensive linemen. Their job, to stop other men's sperm from scoring. Some sperm even have a dual role, blocking other sperm, but allowing their own sperm with their genes to penetrate more effectively. Now, during a man's orgasm, the brain is firing like a lit-up pinball machine, causing contractions in most muscles of the body. The purpose, like a woman's, these contractions help increase the chance of pregnancy by enabling the penis to penetrate as deeply as possible. The glands that make semen, mostly the prostate, squeeze repeatedly, propelling sperm as deep and as far as possible. The prostate, by the way, is often referred to as the male G-spot because it's made up of some of the same types of tissues as some of the spots identified around the nerve plexus that is the G-spot in women and can be stimulated in a similar fashion by some adventuresome couples. Normally, ejaculation can send semen forward through a man's urethra and out the tip of his penis. Semen, by the way, contains hormones like oxytocin that also have a feel-good effect on women. The reason ejaculation never gets mixed up with urine is that there's a tiny muscle at the entrance of the bladder that prevents semen from slipping backward or urine from propelling forward during orgasm. It's a roadblock of sorts, so the only way for the semen to go is out. Now, some men suffer from what's called retrograde ejaculation, in which that tiny muscle doesn't quite work right, causing semen to backtrack into the bladder rather than to the promised land. Causes for this include some side effects of surgery and medications. Retrograde ejaculation doesn't affect the man's ability to achieve an erection or ejaculate, but it may affect his fertility. The opposite of retrograde ejaculation, of course, is when semen shoots out faster than a round from an Uzi, something that can cause angst in men and stop a satisfying sex session in its tracks. Premature ejaculation can be caused by a number of things, including medication, hormonal changes, high blood pressure, and stress. One of the other causes, an enlarged prostate. Since the prostate generates 95% of the substance that comes out during ejaculation, it's no wonder that it has a lot to say about what comes out and when. Since an enlarged prostate gets more stimulation during sex, the friction can stimulate orgasm, leading a man to ejaculate whether he wants to or not. U-tips, improving your love life. Reinvent your relationship. Many couples gradually grow apart and have to reconnect. Why? A woman marries a man because she appreciates his potential and then tries to adjust him to fulfill his potential. Conversely, A man marries a woman who is exactly what he wants, and then she goes off and changes. So in effect, as soon as you fall in love, both of you start racing in different directions. Thankfully for you and any offspring, you're held together by chemical handcuffs, such as dopamine and oxytocin. But as their levels wane and the cuffs slip off after 5 to 7 years, you need to continually reinvent the marriage. People who have been married 30 years have really had 4 marriages. Next time you're not talking to each other, use his insight as an icebreaker. Don't talk to him like he's a woman. Women, who are typically much more in tune with relationship issues than men are, tend to have a better handle on communication, while men don't as easily pick up on subtle clues that women project into relationships. So, teach the man in your life about these insights, and don't assume he knows what you want, even if you think it's obvious. So to be happier, share your expectations. Do the little things. Sometimes we think that relationships are made or broken on the grand gestures, the big fights, the 4-foot teddy bears won at the carnival. But we could strengthen our relationships immensely with more attention to the details. Try these. Do something positive every day to deposit a good feeling in your relationship. A note on a napkin, a kiss on the cheek, a helping hand on a home project. Make a date. Plan time together for just the two of you. Share meals when possible. Take a walk. Hold hands. Or just sit on the couch and catch up while the kids are in the other room playing Wii. Compliment daily. A well-timed, great hair, honey, can prevent you and your partner from taking each other for granted. Negotiate. The only rules in a marriage are those that you both agree on. As long as no one is harmed, and this is key, any rules or policies between partners may be negotiable. That could deal with anything from finances to parental discipline to how you decide where you go on vacation. You go on vacation, right? This will help you maintain a relationship filled with vitality and passion. So again, that means you need to talk through your issues and your desires. Compromise on big issues, or at least agree to take turns taking the lead on making big decisions. Develop a shared vision. In your prenuptial conversations, you may have decided not to have children, to raise children in a certain religion, or never to buy artificially flavored drinks. All those pre-marriage goals and values are well and good, but you will continually be challenged by new issues and problems. Kids, death, money. So an important tool is to be able to talk through and develop a shared vision, especially as your relationship evolves. In developing a shared vision, both partners must develop, grow, and work with each other, and talk through problems in non-judgmental ways. And if you disagree, take advantage of the different approaches to solving problems that each gender brings to the argument. Give your spouse space. A lot of us think that marriage and commitment have to come with a 24/7 contract. You're together all the time. You live together, you eat together, you vacation together. Heck, you can't even use the bathroom without knowing where your better half is. But partners in any relationship need a little space and can actually thrive on it. They need to live their own lives as well as develop their own interests and friends. It's unrealistic to expect another person to fulfill your every need. The truth is that couples grow when individuals can remain individuals. Why? Because each of you will bring more back to the marriage if you're relaxed and refreshed. Be unpredictable. Can you name 3 things that would please your spouse right now? Yes? Then do one of them. Right now, go ahead. We'll still be here when you get done. Remember, the surprise isn't necessarily what you would do per se. It's the fact that you unexpectedly took the time to do something special. Try the Your Way, His Way 4-week trial. Sounds kinky, eh? Here's how it works. For 2 weeks, you make every major decision. All decisions, big and small, except for sex, which must always be consensual, go your way. Then, for the next 2 weeks, your partner will make all the decisions. It goes for everything. What you're having for dinner? What time you go to bed, what you watch on TV, whether you spend Saturday at Starbucks or cleaning out the garage. While it may seem a little odd, it actually works in helping mend relationships that may have conflict. Why? First,